Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And on our show today, Adam, we will be talking with Dr. Karen Rhodes, the Assistant Professor and Director of Healthcare Policy Research in the Department of Emergency Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, about access to specialty care for children.
Yeah, I think this is a real interesting question. You know, if you have private insurance versus if you have Medicaid, do you get treated different by a specialist in terms of trying to get seen? Or maybe even do you even get treated differently by a primary care physician? Maybe we'll get into that conversation too.
Interesting questions. But first, we're going to answer some questions that relate to research that matters. We're going to talk about, does the color of your phlegm mean anything about whether it's bacteria or virus?
Very yucky question.
About hospitalizations tied to energy drinks.
I definitely want to drink to that.
And are patients preferring longevity over quality of life?
Yeah, and I think this will challenge maybe some assumptions that we have. And finally, about talk therapy and fibromyalgia. Really interesting research today, Christy. Let's dive into this very first research that came from the European Respiratory Journal about the color of phlegm.
Okay.
I mean, oh my goodness, what a great research question.
Well, and if you're out there listening, raise your hand if you think that having green or yellow phlegm means you need an antibiotic. A lot of people.
I've got one hand up, Christy, and one hand down.
Well, honestly, I have. I mean, this has been an indicator that people have used, doctors, patients alike, sort of on a rough level, sort of as you can't really decide. I don't know about you, Adam, but, you know, I can't really decide, does the patient need an antibiotic or not? If the sputum's really green and going on for a long time, then, you know,
and if it
maybe
was white, usually saying, it probably is not bacterial. That's what we would kind of think. And that's why we ask the question, what color is your sputum?
Exactly. So this was a study of 4,000 people with chronic bronchitis. And that's important to point out. These were not just everyday people who got a cold that were coughing up green stuff, but people who have ongoing chronic bronchitis.
And they tested them to see with their sputum if they grew out bacteria. And 18% of those who had clear or white sputum tested positive for bacteria, compared to 46 to 59% of those who had green or yellow colored sputum.
So yellow was 46%, green was 59%. So suggesting that in this group of people with chronic bronchitis, that if you have green or yellow, then it does make it more likely that an antibiotic would be helpful to you.
Or at least that you have bacteria there. It doesn't necessarily say if you actually have to take the antibiotics, which is the next research. So I really want to see additional research here, Christy, which is, okay, we know this, but how many of those actually clear spontaneously? Because we know 75-85% of ear infections
get better on their own.
And so maybe this is part of that question. But it does, you know, I do think if you tell me you got green or yellow sputum, you're much more likely now to get antibiotics, or at least to say it might be reasonable.
Yeah, there's a temptation to overcall this research, so be cautious about it.
Speaking of overcalling, let's look at this next research here about hospitalizations and energy drinks. This was a really interesting study.
Well, and I've heard this from my husband, the emergency doctor, about people taking energy drinks, having more visits to the ER. And in this case,
why?
Well, I'll tell you, based on the research that
matters.
Originally,
I would think, energy drinks, they're just like caffeine and other things. That's no big deal.
Yeah. Well, and they would argue that the energy drink people, that it just contains half the caffeine of a similar size cup of coffee. I've taken them before, in full disclosure, and nothing bad happened, but
you didn't combine them with alcohol, medicine for attention deficit disorder, and Prozac.
I did not. You are correct. So in this study, they found that hospitalizations and ER visits have jumped tenfold dramatically from 2005 to 2009, probably because these things are more available and more popular. But the interesting part is that this increase was related very strongly to using the drinks in combination with other medications or substances, which, you know, obviously not a great idea.
No, and it does raise questions, you know, whose responsibility is this? Is it really the responsibility of the energy drink makers when kids are using them wrong, or is the marketing perhaps of them in such a way? But we have to do something. We have to intervene. We have to do education. We really need to think about this more, and that's why we're actually bringing this question up. So I guess take-home point, if you have a child or you yourself are using energy drinks, be aware that they're, particularly with interaction with other substances, there could be a problem.
Yeah. Take them cautiously if you're going to do it at all. Okay. The next one is a surprising finding to me, and this is about heart patients. We know that people who have ongoing chronic illness or who have lots of pain may make choices preferring quality of life versus living longer while suffering. But this is a question looking at elderly persons with heart failure to determine their priorities.
Yeah, this published in the European Heart Journal, they looked at over 500 elderly heart failure patients, you know, people who may be approaching towards the end of their lives, and saying at that point in time, would you trade a longer life over more quality life? And they did, which kind of goes counterintuitive, perhaps, at least the way I initially thought maybe many people would answer, which suggests that maybe there's a bias when you're healthier to thinking, oh, I would always want quality.
Right. Well, I think also you have to think about quality of life, and heart patients may be different than quality of life if you have cancer and are on all these tubes, and or maybe if you're in a lot of pain. Because a lot of times we think about quality and pain and suffering, and in the patients with heart failure, it may be different because we have so many different good medications that makes the suffering less. So I wanted to tease out more of that sort of qualitative aspect of what the patient's symptoms were and in the context of their quality of life.
Yeah, and those one thing they did say is that if for patients who were older, some patients who were female or had more severe symptoms, they were more willing to trade longer longevity over quality of life. I think this suggests that we need to remove our assumptions about what we think
yes.
people want and have the conversation.
Absolutely. Find out your values and your priorities and tailor that to you.
Let's talk about our very last research that matters about fibromyalgia and use of digital technology or the mobile phone technology. So delivering cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, by phone.
Well, we know that CBT, this type of therapy, is effective. It can help people manage chronic pain. It's helpful for fibromyalgia. But, you know, think about it. It can be expensive. It can be hard to find a therapist. It can be hard to drive to get to that appointment. And so this was a study looking at talk therapy done over the phone.
Yeah, this was done in Great Britain, and over 440 people who had widespread pain from fibromyalgia, and they were either given 10 telephone-based cognitive behavioral therapy sessions with a therapist, or given free sessions with the fitness instructor, and they were told to exercise regularly, or they got both.
And, you know, for the people who had the therapy and the exercise sessions, about 33% of them who had one or both treatments said they were feeling much better, compared with only 8% who got the sort of usual treatment group, suggesting that doing it over the phone can be really helpful and may remove some of those barriers to care.
Yeah, I think this is an emerging area. We continue to bring some research here. I think if you have fibromyalgia, it's clear that cognitive behavioral therapy should be part of the picture, and perhaps we can have innovative ways of delivering it that are cost-effective and can be paid for by insurance. Well, Christy, that really concludes our research that matters. We've had a chance to talk about fibromyalgia and CBT.
And we've talked about heart failure patients preferring longevity over quality of life in this study.
About perhaps this rise in hospitalizations with sports energy drinks being combined with other substances. That's a no-no.
And the possibility that green or yellow phlegm is more likely to be bacterial in patients who have chronic bronchitis. So hopefully that research that matters is useful to you. It certainly concludes this portion of our show. We're going to take a little break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Karen Rhodes about access to specialty care for children. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're talking with Dr. Karen Rhodes, Assistant Professor and Director of Healthcare Policy Research in Emergency Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, about access to specialty care for children.
Thanks for being with us, Dr. Rhodes.
Oh, thank you so much for paying attention to this issue.
Yeah, well, Adam and I were just talking a few weeks ago on our Research That Matters segment about a study looking at access to care for children who had a broken arm or who needed mm-hmm. an orthopedic doctor, and finding research showing that it's really very difficult for children to get in with an orthopedic doctor in general, and then if they didn't have the right kind of insurance, perhaps more difficult, which is what led us to your research, and we're glad to have you to talk to us about that more broadly.
Yes, I'm familiar with the study that you're speaking about, and it was definitely helped stimulate some of my thinking in this area.
Well, you know, one of the things that I think that Christy and I first really wanted to expand and why we wanted you on the show today is we read your work in the New England Journal of Medicine looking at this access to specialty care for children with public insurance. So this isn't like people didn't have any insurance. How did you get interested in this? Because you're an emergency room doctor. Mm-hmm. You see children and adults coming in with all types of insurance. How did you get interested in this topic?
So I was actually designing a computer risk assessment and interested to screen patients for their psychosocial issues in the emergency department and needed medical care issues. And I wanted to give them phone numbers that they could follow up as part of the computer survey. So if they didn't have a primary care doc, that we would give them a number where they could get them. So in order to test whether or not the numbers worked, I made the calls myself. And I had incredible trouble finding out if people, you know, could get in for an appointment. There were long waits. There was long messages.
Explain that in a little more detail. I've never heard
myself.
This. Yeah, yeah. Calls to
trying
whom?
Trying to find out where my patients could get follow-up care.
Wow.
And you were calling from the physician perspective, like
I
as a physician.
I was calling as a physician who wanted to make sure I was giving patients the right phone numbers.
And people were giving you the runaround about time to get in, or were they asking you about insurance status or what?
Well, all of the above, in addition to just finding out that there were a lot of wrong numbers and thinking about how hard and how long it took to even find out if it was possible to get an appointment. And so in the process, I thought, wow, this is, you know, I'm sending people out of the emergency department saying, follow up, you know, in 2 days with your primary care doc or with the orthopedic doctor or whatever, you know, name your specialty. And I couldn't even as a physician try to get in. So I thought, this is worth studying.
Well, and it's interesting from knowing my husband's an emergency medicine physician. Uh-huh. And, you know, sort of here, and we talk as primary care doctors, you know, why did that patient go to the ER? Like, why are they going there for care for their toe that's been hurting for 4 months or whatever? And as physicians, we think, oh, well, we could navigate that for them, or they should know they can go somewhere else. But in fact, you're discovering that it's not as easy even for a physician to navigate.
Right. And so I thought, and actually my interest in it was trying to figure out why patients were using the emergency department as opposed to going to their own primary care physician. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, around this time period, you probably remember, there was a lot of push not only to get non-urgent so-called patients out of the emergency department, but not to admit people who could actually be managed as outpatients.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a Robert Wood Johnson clinical scholar, and I, as part of a research design course, I thought up a research design that would test whether or not a patient with who needed urgent follow-up care could get an appointment within a week.
Well, tell us tell us briefly, because I think, first off, you're a young researcher, and coming up with an article that ultimately is in the New England Journal of Medicine is an accomplishment for at any age. But your design, I think, was really innovative. Tell us about how you went about testing this question.
So I used a an audit methodology, they call it, which is basically a deceptive design where a research assistant calls up and asks, pretending to be, in the case of this most recent article, a mother seeking an appointment for a child who needs some urgent follow-up care. And the scenario is I wanted to maximize the chance that that kid could get in.
So you designed things like a broken arm that needed follow-up or a dermatology lesion that wasn't getting better with steroids that was either referred from the primary care doctor or referred from an emergency physician.
Right.
As I looked at the scenarios, they were all things that I thought, yeah, that's not just somebody calling for basic care of the specialist, but something that needs the specialty care.
But I didn't rely only on my, knowledge and experience as an emergency physician. I pulled together a huge advisory board that had specialists in each category to say, yeah, this one needs to be seen. Yes, we think this needs specialty care. And I had primary care docs who advised me, primary care pediatricians in this case, and specialists in each area.
So everybody
agreed these kids needed to be seen by a specialist.
And you actually end up having multiple specialties listed. And when you said it was deceptive, I mean, this went through an institutional review board, and these are essentially simulated patient encounters, right?
Exactly. They're simulated patient encounters. And the beauty of it is that you, with an audit methodology, is that it's similar to other well-designed clinical trials in terms of its experimental design. So you can control for things like, parents' knowledge of education, language, transportation, and all of the other things that we do know go into accessing care and getting a child into access for care.
So you had these callers call in with a script of a story and then call in some other time. And the major variation was what kind of insurance a child had.
That was the only main thing that varied. Obviously, the names were different, but
multiple different specialties involved. And let's talk about what you found, because this is really striking. Tell us the summary.
So basically, looking across all of these conditions, we were able to generate a reliable, valid measure of children's access to outpatient specialty care. And we found important disparities in access for children with public compared to private insurance.
Public insurance being Medicaid.
Medicaid and CHIP.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the, I should mention that this study took place in Cook County, Illinois. It's the second largest metropolitan area in the country.
So lots of specialists there.
Right. And high rates of specialists per population. And we found that 2/3 of children who had Medicaid CHIP were unable to get an appointment for medical conditions that required timely outpatient specialty care, including such things as diabetes and, new onset seizures. At the same time, the factitious child, the same person who would be calling, with a child with an identical symptoms who said they had private insurance, was turned away only 11% of the time.
Wow. You know, Dr. Rhodes, we're going to need to take a short break, but this incredible disparity between across all specialties here is something that we really want to pick up on and extend this conversation and really understand what this means and what can be done about it. So we're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Karen Rhodes, about access to specialty care for children. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Adam and I have been talking with Dr. Karen Rhodes about access to specialty care for children. And in particular, Dr. Rhodes, we were talking about the findings of your study showing that children who have public insurance, being Medicaid and the like, had a harder time getting an appointment at all in just outpatient specialty care, and wondered if you'd also mention the summary about the length of time.
Yeah, and I guess one question, because you said there was almost a threefold difference across all specialties of their, if they had public insurance, they're being able to access specialty care less than, almost two-thirds could not, compared to 90% plus almost of those with private insurance. Is there a difference between primary care's ability patients to access primary care physicians if you've got good private insurance versus Medicaid or CHIP?
We didn't measure that in this study. In a prior study, I did look at access to primary care, but it was for adults who had been seen in an emergency department and were referred for a potentially life-threatening condition, like, for example, a threatened ectopic pregnancy or accelerating hypertension.
And what'd you find?
We found even worse than for the children, we found that adults with potentially life-threatening conditions who were seen in an emergency department had trouble getting in within a week to a primary care provider. And in that case, the sampling frame wasn't all potential, providers. It was, we were calling the primary care providers who were on call in the emergency department in 9 cities.
Well, and I was also struck in the PEDS study about the length of time. So even if they did get an appointment, so they weren't likely to get one at all, but if they did, that the wait time was something like 22 days longer. And so, that's medically inappropriate in a lot of these scenarios to wait that long.
That's true. We found that, and we found really two dimensions of disparity in access to care. One of them was whether or not you could get an appointment at all. And then just in the group that gave an appointment, the clinics that gave an appointment to children with both types of insurance, we found that children who were on Medicaid CHIP had faced longer wait times.
And so thinking about, surely you've done a lot of thought into what this means and what we need to do with this information. Is this about healthcare reform? Is this about training more primary care doctors to meet some of these needs?
So I really think it's about restructuring the way we provide specialty care. And I think we need to shift around existing resources so we can improve care coordination, and that would make a huge difference in access. And you're both primary care physicians. One of the key ways of doing this is to strengthen the medical home.
Absolutely. You're speaking our language now.
Right. Yeah. And primary care medical homes have been shown to decrease hospitalizations and decrease ED use and increase the appropriate use of specialty care. In this case, we controlled for whether or not it was appropriate. But a primary care provider can, help facilitate that access, but they also need the support of institutions. So I do think it is about healthcare reform. And the scary thing about this is that, the Affordable Care Act is going to provide health insurance to an additional 38 million people, and they're going to use a combination of the exchanges and Medicaid. So we know that having any insurance is better than none. You know, the uninsured get less care, live sicker, die younger. So, but we didn't study the uninsured, as you pointed out. We studied insured children. So this group, you know, we want all children to have an opportunity to see a doctor based on whether, when they need to see them, well, not their insurance status.
Mm-hmm. And part of the issue is we assume that just because you have insurance that the doctor will see the patient, but there are questions about, you know, we know that there are tremendous variations on what different insurances and reimburse providers, and that influences their ability to accept those types of insurance.
Absolutely right. There's also issues around capacity that are going to need to be addressed. Particularly, you brought up the primary care capacity, and I didn't finish the adult piece. But what we found was even privately insured adults, Blue Cross Blue Shield, can go anywhere, only had a 65% chance in getting in to see their primary care doctor or a primary care doctor who was on call for the emergency department.
What?
So within a week. So that is a primary care capacity issue. I don't think we have the same issue around specialty care. I think it's a more of an efficiency issue. We need to build up primary care so we have more capacity, and we need to restructure the way we provide specialty care.
Well, let me ask a question. You know, you've published here in the New England Journal of Medicine with your co-author. You've published an article in the Journal of the American Medical Association. What is happening when you're putting research like this out there that really is pretty clear about what you're finding, pretty dramatic in the results, but perhaps really difficult to change or implement? What do you see out there with what's happening with this work? And is there hope from what maybe you're seeing as a result of getting this type of work out to the public?
I think there is. I mean, this particular study of child access to specialty care was financed by the state of Illinois. Now, they had to because it followed on a class action suit, but nonetheless, they picked a rigorous study design, and they should be applauded because they're the very first state to measure their access to care, specialty care for children. Every state needs to do this. So I say the policy thing is nothing improves if it's not measured. So we need to study access to care for children and adults alike, and we need to know if there's disparities, and we need to... You know, that needs to be out there in the public. And I think, people like you and, with the radio programs and the newspaper articles about this, it can help translate these findings. Well, in a way that makes it accessible to people.
And we are grateful to be in a department at UNC in family medicine that does a lot of work with our state Medicaid program through Community Care of North Carolina and really is coming up with innovative ways to solve some of these problems and take care of our Medicaid patients in a new mm-hmm. way with really wonderful findings. But, you know, thinking about the broader context, what do you think are the next steps? Like, what are the next questions? You talked about some mandatory evaluation from every state, but what's really the next level of research?
Well, I'm interested in studying what sort of primary care capacity we have before and after the Affordable Care Act.
So if we have reformed and we're pushing people into having medical homes and we're pushing to have mm-hmm. health care organizations to be more accountable and cost efficient in prevention, but we don't have enough primary providers to do all these things, isn't there going to be a gap of 20 or 30 years here? What are we going to do?
So I think I'd like to turn the question around mm-hmm. because you're in primary care. What do you think the solutions are?
Well, I think this is perfect because we have a residency director here who mm-hmm. I think is working on, and we have these discussions largely hidden from the public about well, what is our responsibility to train more providers, particularly when we have not gotten the resources from the federal government or the state governments to train, which is very expensive.
Well, and we are in an exciting time in family medicine and in primary care because we need to train. I mean, it's very clear that primary care and a strong workforce is the answer to a lot of these problems for our workforce needs. And we've got problems in our own state. And so it's certainly part of our mission at the University of North Carolina and as a discipline in family medicine to look critically at this, to train more doctors, to better prepare them to meet a lot of these needs. We see our doctors as because they have the broad training to be able to go into a community and if they need that kind of training to be able to adapt to the needs of that community. And open access and a lot of our innovations are a piece mm-hmm. of this. But we're excited to talk with you and to have an opportunity to hear about this really important research and are grateful. We do need to wrap up, but we're grateful that you're with us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Well, and I think you've actually ask the question. You provide answers in your article and incredible research, and we're really grateful for that, but maybe asking the right questions here that we all need to focus on. So thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
We've been talking with Dr. Karen Rhodes about access to specialty care for children. We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I are going to take a few minutes to talk about your health questions and concerns.
You can send us your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu, and we will listen to them on the air. And we've got some questions today from our listeners, Christy, about Clostridium difficile colitis. That's a mouthful.
Yeah, I'm with diarrhea. And yeah. About ADHD and having
attention
high blood
deficit,
pressure.
Attention deficit hyperactivity disorder.
And about strep throat.
And when to treat, when to wait, and a lot of other interesting questions. And then something called lockjaw.
All right. Well, let's get started with our first House Call question.
A friend of mine had diarrhea and was recently diagnosed with C. diff. Is this something I should be worried about also getting? Thanks for your advice.
You know, C. diff is what we usually call it, is the shorter way to talk about Clostridium difficile because that sounds very fancy. C. diff is usually associated with taking antibiotics. And so you sort of have these normal bacteria that live in your gut. And if you take antibiotics, sometimes that can kind of disrupt things a little bit and you can get this C. diff that can cause all kinds of crazy diarrhea.
And the good news is you don't have to worry about getting it if you're just because your friend had. You're not going to get it unless you had antibiotics from that aspect. This is not like that contagious form of diarrhea like
salmonella
or shigella or something like that.
Although I have had a patient before who caught community-acquired C. diff that wasn't on antibiotics at the time. So it's usually...
It can happen, but it'd be rare. It'd be
very,
real unusual, right?
It'd be
right.
Very unusual.
Yeah. I mean, maybe if you're in a nursing home...
Exactly.
...or you're in a hospital with sharing a bed with someone who has that C. diff...
Exactly.
...then you should
Much
be cautious.
More likely in a nursing home or a hospital setting than out in the community. So I would wash your hands still, but I wouldn't worry about catching
because
it.
Because it's a toxin that is released there. And it's treatable and... hopefully your friend's getting the appropriate treatment, and hopefully you don't have it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's hear our House Call question about ADHD and hypertension or high blood pressure.
I am a 25-year-old man with ADHD who also has hypertension. I recently was put on Cymbalta but had side effects. The same was true when I tried Lyrica. However, I can't take stimulants because of my high blood pressure. What else can I try taking? I've also been treated for depression in the past. Thanks.
Good question.
It's a tricky one.
It is because, you know, there's lots of elements to this question. What are you thinking about? What are you thinking about?
Well,
first?
I'm thinking I want more information. There's ADHD and then there's depression in the past. So I'd want to tease out a little bit more about
that.
Well,
let's get our listener back.
I know. We need some more information
but,
from you.
And it's like many great questions, it raises more questions mm-hmm. sometimes than the answers. But it also makes me realize that a lot of times when we're picking out medicines for patients and listeners, we're oftentimes thinking about, well, can we have one medicine that treats two different things sometimes? And you know, sometimes when we have a medicine for pain, it also may lower someone's blood pressure. And we, well, boy, that works out well if they have high blood pressure.
Right. And in this case, you know, certain ADHD medicines can raise your blood pressure.
Which is not the wrong way.
And certain blood pressure medicines can sort of make you feel more tired and depressed.
Which isn't good for ADHD.
No. So lots of things to consider. It sounds like you've tried Lyrica and Cymbalta and some other options.
You can't take most of the stimulants because they do raise your blood pressure. Most of the common medicines like Ritalin, they're probably not indicated. You can't take them if you have high blood pressure easily.
Well, and I guess I would step back and say, okay, for the ADHD part, do you truly need medicine to function and survive? Are there elements of behavioral changes in your life, structure, things that you can do through therapy or non-medicine routes that can help you still thrive in the setting of ADHD? That may not be true, but it might be.
Right. There are all kinds of behavioral strategies and new tools and techniques. I agree with you perfectly, Christy. And then also there are some classes of medicines you mentioned that you have been treated for depression in the past, and there's this medicine called Wellbutrin. Bupropion is its generic name, and it is inexpensive, and it works well for minor depression, but it also has some evidence of effectiveness with things like attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, so that might be one option.
And it's not one that's known to raise your blood pressure.
Yeah.
Although if you had seizures, you wouldn't want to take that medicine, but otherwise it's pretty good. Safe medicine to try. Some people might also try an SSRI like Prozac or Zoloft. There are lots of different flavors of that that could make a difference for depression, certainly, and may make a difference in ADHD as well without raising your blood pressure.
Hopefully that's a little bit helpful. Thank you for your question. Let's listen to our very next house call.
I recently had a sore throat and went to see my doctor, who told me I had strep throat and gave me an antibiotic. I felt better after a few days and stopped the antibiotic. Unfortunately, my sore throat returned. And now I have a question. Should I wait to see if it goes away? Should I get tested for strep? Or should I simply bite the bullet and take antibiotics again? This time for the full course. Thanks.
Uh-oh.
Strep throat.
and partially taking antibiotics. Why does this seem like this is familiar? Maybe it's because they're talking about me and my family sometimes.
I mean,
this is something that I've heard of and experienced.
And
I know it.
I've had a very similar story myself. Strep is everywhere, first of all, and it hurts. And so I'm sorry that you've been suffering.
And you start feeling better when you're taking your antibiotics. So you think, I don't need to take them anymore.
Exactly. It's so common. But yet, you really do need the antibiotics to get rid of that bacteria. So, you know, these questions you ask of retesting or getting more antibiotics or waiting are good questions. And I'd want to tease out a little bit more about your symptoms to guide you. But all of them are pretty reasonable options.
Yeah, you know, this is one of those questions where we can say yes, yes, yes.
That sounds reasonable.
Under certain circumstances, they could perhaps all be reasonable because there maybe isn't a complete right or wrong answer here. And it depends on somewhat your values and maybe how strongly the physician that you're going may only give you one or two of these options, may not actually give you all three options.
Well, and I would say that if you retest, I mean, the risk there is that it's partially treated, so it may not come out positive, but it may be still there brewing and causing you some symptoms.
And you might not then change what you do.
Right. So if it's not going to change, if you're still going to want the antibiotics, then, you know, that's worth considering. If you do get more antibiotics, you could do penicillin or amoxicillin, but you also could get the shot. And that would sort of make sure that you actually get the medicine that you need and you don't have to keep remembering to take it all the time.
And then maybe waiting, because it may or may not, it may go away in a couple days. And there's probably not a great risk to waiting a couple days either. So under certain circumstances, all of these could be reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a great question. Let's listen to our very last house call.
My friend is having problems with their jaw locking constantly the last few days. It happened once before. I've heard about tetanus. Is this something to worry about?
Lockjaw. Well, we don't hear that term in our medicine groups a lot, but it is the appropriate term for one of the most serious, preventable, treatable diseases that we don't talk about a lot, but God, I'm so glad this question came up.
Yeah. So, I mean, we hear lockjaw, we think tetanus.
Yeah.
As many listeners out there probably thought when you heard that word. And there's a fancy word, trismus.
T-R-I-S-M-U-S. MUS. And we'll get our friends at the Health Sciences Library to make a link on our show with about trismus, because this is tetanus is a serious problem. It's preventable, but it's rare in the United States.
Rare.
Because most people do have their immunizations, and unless you've had an injury, and you didn't talk about an injury where you stepped on a rusty nail, that's almost impossible, but not impossible, but rare to get unless you had that injury and you haven't been vaccinated.
And so other reasons to feel like you can't close your mouth all the way or you can't move your jaw as well as normal could be related to an infection. So if you had a real bad infection in your throat, sometimes it's hard to close your mouth. Or if you had an infection in a tooth.
An abscess from a tonsil. But the most likely thing is probably due to grinding of the teeth. Common things happen commonly, and that's a common thing that a lot of people have. People who chew gum or chew on ice, and they get inflammation in their temporomandibular joint.
Or TMJ.
TMJ. And that, boy, you need to go see a primary care doctor. You need to
see a
ear, nose,
perhaps,
and throat, a dentist. And there are some treatments that can be done, including anti-inflammatory medication and heat and gentle massage and even an injection if needed.
Right. Dental guards or all kinds of things they can do.
But if you don't, you didn't have fever and are really getting problems with your swallowing, those are things you have to go see an emergency doctor and to be seen quickly.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully this is already better by the time you hear us talking. Thank you for your questions. Thank you for being with us today. We hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to you and your health. And we want you to share your stories. Give us your questions. Email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Follow us online at yourhealthradio.org, on Twitter, Facebook, and iTunes.
We'd like to thank WCHL Radio, UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their great sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Karen Rhodes. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360, WCHL.